So today we have people from different places gathered for this introduction to Buddhism. So we have done it several times, and this is the ninth introduction to Buddhism. So perhaps this is the biggest gathering that we have so far. So we have people from students from many different schools, and also teachers and from many different schools here. So I would like to greet you all with Tashi Delek. So all of you have come here happily. So those of you who debated here, I would like to greet you, and for taking interest in debate and Buddhist philosophy. It's not easy, but you still have taken interest in it and are studying. It's very good. In Tibet, in the past, also amongst the lay people, there almost didn't exist anyone who studied Buddhist philosophy and through debate, dialectical debate, and even amongst the nuns as well. Those in monastic institutions where they had, the study of philosophy through dialectical debate, of course they did. They were doing very well. But generally speaking, from amongst the lay people and the general public, they didn't exist. The study of philosophy. Of course, there was education in Tibet in the past, but general public didn't take much interest in education. It has been our habit, but is it a good one or a bad one? Of course, bad one. And it is actually a drawback. So if we actually leave it as it is it right to do so? No. If something is backward and we need to change, we must do that and make improvements. So since we came to exile, it's been 56 years. Over 56 years, therefore, after coming to exile, I have urged people to actually, even those monasteries and nunneries which didn't have the study of philosophy through debate, some nunneries started studying. With this philosophy through dialectical debate, and also the Namgyal Monastery, Pendeleshe Ling Monastery, which was mostly involved in rituals, which were very of high standard. Since the 7th Dalai Lama, who took special interest in compiled the different rituals, and also invited people from Shalu monasteries who knew the Kala Chakra Tantra and the different rituals and ritual dance and so forth. And they were asked to teach them, Namgyal Monastery monks. And so Namgyal Monastery, although it had a very high quality of these rituals and study and education of ritual on rituals, but they didn't have study of Buddhist philosophy. And similarly, and the Gyudu and Gyume monasteries of Tantric College and these Tantric colleges also didn't have study of philosophy. And now they have started studying it. And they have these classes in Buddhist philosophy as well as, and also the in nunneries, we have nuns who study Buddhist philosophy, and we are at a point of time where even nuns are now about to become geishis or geishi mas. And then, as I also urged the general public and the lay people also to pursue the study of philosophy through dialectical debate, which has been taken seriously, and you've been doing this, and they've been doing this. And then, although they have not reached the advanced study deeply, but they have now started and begun to do that. And also in the Himalayan regions of India, Ladakh, and so forth, we have this same tradition now being taken up by the lay people studying philosophy through dialectical debate. So there's they're setting good examples. Although in Tibet, Buddhism spreads the length and breadth of Tibet, but if you really look closely, although we have a very high quality of the teaching of the Buddha, the majority of the people remained rather ignorant about this teaching, this tradition, merely staying within faith. So if we do not have anything to do with Buddhism with regard to him, if we cannot use logic and reasoning to go keep up with its practice, then of course we may be able to say we can follow it on faith alone, but that's not the case. In Tibet we have this teaching of the Buddha, such as the Prajaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and also the this Sanskrit tradition of Buddhism, which spread in Takshashila and in Takshashila, Nalanda, Vikramashila, and so forth. So we have the great classic texts of the great masters from the Nalanda, in this monastic tradition, Nalanda monastery. So we have a tradition of Buddhism which can be actually analyzed through reason and logic and to demonstrate the truth. And we do not have to actually resort only to scriptural citation saying that, oh, this is so-and-so because Buddha said so, or this is so-and-so because such and such scholar said so, or the great panditas, or the great mahasiddhas, or the accomplished masters have said so-and-so. That's not how we go about with the teaching that we have. But we use reason and then also see whether the teachings go against reason or not, and also by try to see if it corroborates with our own experience as well. If we apply the teaching within us, if we can actually cultivate it within us and have the experience. And so the teaching that we have is not against reason, and And because of that, we can't do critical analysis into the teaching. The Buddha himself has said, or monks and scholars, just as a gold is tested by burning, cutting, and rubbing, therefore, you should examine my teaching, investigate my teaching, and not just and accept it, but not because you have faith or devotion to me. And so this is what the Buddha himself has said, that you do not have to take my words without doing any. You must investigate and also experiment the teaching that I have given. And so the Buddha has said that, and said that we must not follow him or believe him just because we follow him. So there's no danger of actually losing our ground if we follow reason. And there are stories about certain beings who are called Bungusotsi. Why certain people are born as Bungusotsi is because it is said that they were monks who were very good at debate, but were not so tamed mentally, and because of that, their pride and so forth, after their death, they are born as spirits. And so I've heard these stories from my assistants for debate in Tibet, and they told me that the monks, during their evening prayer sessions, when they gather, they cannot cover their head with the cape sort of thing, overcoat, kind of monk's overcoat sort of thing. They cannot cover their heads with it because there used to be, they say that there are these Bungusotsis or sometimes attend such prayer sessions. So when I studied the study of Prajaparamita, I studied the text commentary by the fifth Dalai Lama, and at some point he has said that there are donkeys, and Dinsang means actually a good the one with a good throat, but it's a reference to a donkey. And so a donkey wearing the hide or the fur of a lion. And so this refers to those who lamas or people who he says that such people fill this land of the Tibet. And so these are reference to those who actually look very elegant outwardly, with elegant robes and so forth, and sitting on a high throne, but inside are empty, without any knowledge of Buddhism. And so we should not be like that. We should not just be hollow inside while assuming to be of assuming a high throne and position. And so what we need, what we have, as I said before, is this teaching of the Buddha, which can be analyzed and critically investigated with regard to the content. And therefore the Buddha himself had this confidence to say, within himself, confidence in himself to say that the scholars and monks must check and examine my teaching. And so such an excellent tradition that we have, I found it very important, because we have such an excellent tradition, I have found it's important for everybody concerned to study and learn the teaching of the Buddha through critical analysis and debate and so forth. And accordingly, in the last decade, a few decades, we have had people who have seriously paid attention to this project of studying Buddhist philosophy through debate. In the beginning, when we came into exile and we set up the secular schools, Tibetan schools, and when we set up these schools, the students were taught the dialectical debate like we have today. And so there was a very good monk who taught the school children, the students in Missouri, Tibetan school, and the students also did very well in debate. But over time, it seems that the people who have the title of the religious instructors or spiritual instructors in these schools didn't themselves have the knowledge, good knowledge of Buddhist philosophy and then also the debate. And therefore, although we have a very profound subject that we can study, I mean, the teachers themselves lacked that qualification to teach their students. And so there was a generation of Tibetan children who didn't have much understanding of Buddhism, and also they didn't have much experience or knowledge about how to discipline one's mind, make transformation within one's mind. And so people were more attracted towards a materialistic way of life. So I'll speak about this later also. And some time ago, we revived this and put effort, worked hard to revive this tradition of studying, learning, debate, philosophy through logic and debate. So we have not started it because we have nothing else to do. This dialectical debate is something which, in regards to the teaching of the Buddha, it has the... So if we have to preserve and promote the teaching of the Buddha practically, this is a very good tool to do this. So just by carrying a mala, a rosary in your hand and saying some mantras will not help in preserving the teaching, the profound teaching. And also not by having a grand monastery and playing musical instruments like drums and cymbals and so forth, and having a good guest house beside the monastery will not preserve the Dharma, Buddha Dharma as well. And so we have the conjure and thing, which is 100 volume or so. And so these are very tough texts, of course. Therefore, we have the key to open the door to these, which are the Tengur, the exegetical treatises written by Indian masters. And so, therefore, I've always been saying that these texts are not to be placed up on the altar for us to worship, but we need to study them. And so we, in Tibet, there have been so many Tibetan scholars. Maybe there are tens of thousands of their works by Tibetan scholars who came from all parts of Tibet, in central and Yuzhang region, or the Kham region, or the Amda region. And so all these texts are commentaries. I mean, the treatises that they have written are commentaries to the Ganjur and Tenjur as well. And so since the time of Chisong Detsen, the emperor in the 8th century, Tibetan emperor, so for the last so many centuries, over a thousand years. We have had this rich Buddhist tradition, which has been preserved through study. And therefore, for everybody, whether monks or nuns or lay people, should pay attention, take interest in studying Buddhism, the classical texts. And in within Buddhism, we find very detailed information on the psychology as well as philosophy. So with regard to philosophy, just as there is this profound understanding of quantum physics, and so which we have in the Buddhist tradition, in the Nalanda tradition, the writings of the Nalanda masters. We have many writings which actually show that the idea or the concept of quantum physics, which is very popular today. And then with regard to psychology, if you want to do detailed kind of investigation or study of emotions and so forth, in India, within the non-Buddhist and Buddhist traditions, there have been lots of information on the emotions and psychology. And so, although in the non-Buddhist traditions there are many texts written by these great masters of non-Buddhist traditions about psychology, but these are not studied today. So, if we look at the Buddhist texts like Pramanavartika by Dharmakirti, which is a text on logic and epistemology, we'll actually find lots of assertions of the non-Buddhist traditions. And then the Master Dharmakirti actually counters those assertions, and there's lots of debate back and forth. And then later masters also took up or those topics that have been debated before, and by the Buddhist masters, from the non-Buddhist tradition, there were criticism, arguments against the Buddhist tradition, and then Buddhist masters also who came later did the same kind of criticism and argument against the non-Buddhist traditions. So in this way, there has been lots of exchange of knowledge. And so I have been saying to the Indians that we need more Indians with this rich knowledge and that were there in the past. And so amongst the Buddhist tradition, followers of the Buddhist tradition, we have it's only the Tibetans who have this rich Buddhist tradition, which is studied through logic and dialectical debate. And of course, Buddhism has spread in China, Korea, Japan, in Vietnam. There are very good practitioners, of course. But there are very few who actually have good understanding or knowledge of the teaching of the Buddha. And so it seems only Tibetans are the ones who are the custodians of this rich tradition of studying Buddhism through debate. So although we can say this teaching, that the tradition that we have is our treasure, our heritage, but if it's no benefit to anybody, then maybe we can put it up and display the teachings in the museums, but that's not the case. So with regard to psychology, for example, it is very helpful to others. And similarly, it is the case with philosophy. So what are known as the five conventional sciences and the five ultimate science has gotten the ultimate nature of things. So whatever subjects to learn there are, if we could use the dialectical debate and to study them, it would be really good. Even very good scientists, when we have discussions amongst us, many of them actually quite admire this debate. And so yes, just yesterday we had some Emory students who come here in Dharamsala every year, and we have some discussions. And so I met the Emory students and some faculty members. And so one of the faculty actually was with his colleague, and this man actually asked me if this dialectical debate could be used to teach science and other subjects. And we had this discussion just yesterday, and so I have already I told him yes, that's possible. And I told him that many years ago one of the scientists who was having a conference with me actually asked told me that this dialectical debate, if this dialectical debate could be actually used to teach other subjects. And I had actually answered yes, that's possible. And the man yesterday was quite was a young man, and I told him this is possible. And I told him that even the Tibetan students in the secular schools are called putting effort in this, and so we have. Of course, Tibetan students using English when it comes to using the technical terms of science, but they use this subject, these topics of science, in for debate, and within this dialectical debate procedure, they actually debate on the topics of science. So I told this man yesterday that I had discussed with scientists and about using this dialectical debate in other subjects, but nobody really actually came up with a concrete work or project. And so today, since you asked this question, we can actually gather Tibetan scholars who know Buddhist the dialectical debate well, and you could also gather specialists from different subjects, and that so that we could work together, and in this way perhaps we could within a period of 2 years. So we should actually have a project to, which we should start, and so that in 2 years' time we would have some curriculum which can be used where to teach different subjects through the logical process of reductio ad absurdum, or the deductive reasonings. So it's very important to use dialectical debate to study different subjects. So I would like to praise you who are doing this study and who have debated this time. So this time we are mostly gathering for introduction to Buddhism. And today and tomorrow we'll also have some time for question and answer. And then in the afternoon, the scholars would take your questions, and you should have raised questions. And so we should make these few days of gathering a meaningful one, which means to really learn something which is beneficial. So those who are studying the treatises, for example, the text, so earlier some of them debated on, when they were debating, some of them actually quoted certain lines from Yongzhen Pupuchok's Lorik, the study of mind and cognition. So before Jerembuchi came to Tibet, there already was the text on logic and epistemology written by Sakya Pandita, which is called the Treasury of Logic or Epistemology. And so it's very important to learn the Brahmana epistemology. So we have to know, we have to go into those texts, this text by Sakya Pandita, and see what he actually says about the different aspects of mind, which are called correct assumption or and so forth. And then there is the emotional scientist who is called Paul Ekman. He seems to have actually made a list of 15 or so emotions based on facial expressions or the movement of facial muscles. So in our text, we have what are known as the 51 different mental factors. And so according to Paul Ekman's research, he found these 14 or 15 different emotions or... So usually when we debate, we say, we actually challenge the other party by saying, this is, you have to accept this because it is said, such thing is said by such and such scholar. I'm not so favorable. I don't favor that much. Even in the great monastic institutions where they have this kind of study of logic, and they do so. And so... And so they even consider it quite bad for some, for a monk, for example, who follows certain textbook by written by a particular scholar in their monastery. If they go against what that scholar has actually said in the textbook, it's considered bad. So, of course, in India, I mean, and it's already made clear that someone who does not accept the Buddha as authority will not actually accept Buddha's quotations. Indian Buddhist masters were debating with the with some non-Buddhist master, I mean, they won't be able to quote Buddha's words. But they have to use reason. So with regard to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, we have the also the, what are known as the 16 attributes for each of the Four Noble Truths. And so when I was having a discussion with some Thai scholars recently in Delhi, I asked them whether you actually explain the Four Noble Truths and their 16 attributes, their 16 attributes, based on resorting to scripture or reason. And they said resorting to scripture. But Pramanavartika, as we know, does not resort to scriptural citations, but reasoning. And so the attributes, the four attributes of suffering and the four attributes of the origin of suffering are actually called proved through reason and not resorting to scripture. And also Yongzhin Pupuchok's text on mind and cognition, if you are studying it, I mean, you should not just confine yourselves to what is said there, but you also should look at other writings on the same topics by other scholars. And then it will actually expand your scope of knowledge. So in certain texts, there are no mention of what are known as the seven types of cognition, whereas in others there is mention of them. These, and so what are the reasons for doing so? Also, should be understood. Of course, when it comes to very fine matters in teaching, perhaps we need also to resort to very subtle matters. Resort to scriptural authority. But in order to be able to do that, we also need to understand the teachings on emptiness, selflessness, and so forth. And therefore, once you understand the main thrust of the teaching, the Buddha, and through reason, then there are cases where certain matters to really gain insight, you should resort to scripture. Because we can see that because the teachings that can be actually accepted on reason, and when we apply them in our experience, we can develop the realizations within ourselves. And from these realizations and insight that we gain based on such reason, then we can kind of infer, use inference to see, oh, maybe such and such thing is acceptable because of such and such thing being said by the Buddha. And so, so you should not think that the scientists are like nihilists or faithless people, and you know, kind of dismiss them. But of course, they are maybe like that. But then, called the scientists. I mean, if we have discussions with scientists, we can actually share knowledge with them. Even within Buddhist tradition, there are those philosophical schools which differ from each other, such as certain schools being able to accept, I mean, schools accepting selflessness of phenomena and not selflessness, and selflessness of phenomena, persons and not selflessness of phenomena, and others. So I've told somebody about 40 years ago when I began my interest in having discussions with scientists. I told this to an American friend, a Buddhist who has actually become a follower of Tibetan Buddhism. And this person actually said, be careful because science is killer of religion. And so I actually reflected on her statement and actually came up with this idea, understanding that the Buddhism that we have is not merely a tradition which resorts to our scriptural authority alone, but we have reasons to use to demonstrate the truth of the teaching of the Buddha, and therefore I thought it may not be so bad, and so to discuss with scientists, and therefore I have had for the last 30 years or so discussions with scientists, and today we also have Tibetan Buddhist monks in great monastic institutions who have studied and who are studying also to the science, and And we have also included the career science curriculum in the examination of the Geshe degree. So, Je Rinpoche himself, Jetsong Kapa, has said that if you go against, if you actually contradict reason, you cannot accept a certain statement. If a certain statement contradicts reason, and so if Jetsong Kapa says that if you contradict, if you go against reason, you cannot be an authoritative person, then it must be more so if you go against what is empirical experience as well, such as what is said in the Abhidhamma Kosha with regard to the size of the sun and the moon and the distance from the earth and so forth, and then Mount Meru in the center and so forth, which are actually against empirical experience. So we, who are followers of Nalanda tradition, which emphasizes reason, and if we cannot go against something which is based on reason, then we cannot go against, more so, something which is empirical experience. And therefore, I take excuse from Vasubandhu for not accepting what he has said about the cosmos. Although in Abhidhamma Kosha we have very detailed explanation of the different constituent factors of our body, mind, and sources of consciousness and so forth, which can be, of course, accepted. But I very respectfully excuse myself from the accepting Vasubandhu's description of the sun and the moon. I sometimes jokingly say that when he got old, when he became old, perhaps Vasubandhu looked up in the sky and saw the sun and the moon and thought that, oh, there's not much difference in size between the two, and therefore he wrote that the sun is slightly bigger than the moon. And even this is said even in the non-Buddhist scriptures, it seems. And so Mount Meru and some description of Mount Meru and so forth seems to be something which was kind of accepted in those days in India. And then in the 5th century, one of the Nalanda scholars has said that the world is actually spherical. And then certain non-Buddhist scholars have actually criticized that Nalanda scholar. And so, of course, the Nalanda masters didn't have any telescopes or microscopes and so forth, these tools, but they actually used their large intelligence and reasoning. So with regard to what is empirical, if we have to go against it, it's not good. So I don't accept the Mount Meru, but in the Kalachakra Tantra, also there's mention of the Mount Meru, but that is also described as symbolism. So, of course, for a practitioner of Kalachakra Tantra, who has the physiological structure which are explained and described in that Tantra, so in order to ripen, spiritually ripen for the practice of the completion stage practice based on the vital energies, emphasizing the vital points in the body and so forth. And therefore, for such a practitioner to kind of train their mind for these experiences, of course, there are these explanations. Because there is an interaction between the external world and the internal world. So the Mount Meru and so forth are actually used as symbolic. And so this is what I want you to understand, especially those who are studying Tibet. So we first came into in India. We reached in India in Missouri in the April of 1959. Most of you were not even born then. So now we have been 56 years in exile. And I've been in the world. I was born, like, if we count from the beginning of the year, almost 81. And I'm 80 now. So it's definite and sure that I would not live for another 80 years. But physically speaking, given my physical condition, I may live for the next 10, 15, or 20 years. And then I would be like 100 years. So you, the younger generation of Tibetans here, are the ones who would, upon whose shoulder falls the preservation and promotion of our culture, tradition. So inside Tibet, although they wish to do this, but they do not have freedom, but we in exile have freedom. And therefore, using this freedom, we should actually cherish this with the freedom to use the opportunity to for the preservation of our culture. And so, while living in this in a free country, you have the freedom to do any kind of critical analysis, investigation into the tradition, and therefore, your generation is a very important generation, because when it comes to preserving the Tibetan culture and tradition, it has to go on from generation to generation. And my generation, people of my generation, will be gone, will finish. And then when you grow up, you'll say that, oh, when I was young, when we were young, His Holiness the Dalai Lama used to say so and so. And when you become old, you would also, to the next generation, you would be able to introduce how we can keep up with our tradition from generation to generation as well. So we are going to... So I've asked the organizers to print this book on Buddhist psychology, not just for giving some transmission, but when I was young, around 10, I memorized this verse summary of the mind psychology, and also the verse summary of reasoning and logic by Ajahn Yongzhen. So, because it's a summarized, versified text, it's easy to memorize. If you are interested, of course, you memorize this text on mind and cognition. Of course, you may not have to recite it every day, but after having memorized the text, then you may give thought to, and when you come across people who wants to discuss on these topics of mind, you could use it. So there's no oral reading transmission of the text as such, but I just thought that you would have a text to carry with you, and I want to make today we are doing an introduction to Buddhism. As I said earlier, I am an old man of 80 now. Since 25, I lost my country. I had to flee my country. And since I was 16, I lost my personal freedom. And so I lived my life in such circumstances. So when I think about the problems, difficulties inside Tibet, people have so much faith and trust in me. But what can I do? From the Buddhist point of view, we accept karma. But in practical terms also, our previous generations actually caused a lot of drawbacks and created a lot of loopholes in our situation, and therefore the all the conditions were ripe for us to for the results to happen. And so, of course, we have to, when we think about suffering, the noble truth of suffering, then we need to think also, we just can't complain saying there's suffering, but we should think what actually causes suffering. Therefore, we have to go back to go into the understanding of what that cause is, and we come to the origin of suffering. And then with regard to the origin of suffering, there is this ignorance, which is at the root of our unenlightened existence, and therefore we have to see whether this ignorance, which is a misconception, a distorted view about reality, is something which can be overcome, eliminated or not. And if we see, of course, there is a way to overcome it, then we see there is a cessation and so forth. So we have been praying a lot, and reciting mantras, but we have not really applied the teaching within ourselves so that we could actually generate the experiences within ourselves. So for those, if those who know the Dharma are not able to be practical about the teaching, well, what can we do with those who do not know? So there has not been much interest that people have taken, although people have studied the text, but they have actually used this knowledge to externalize, as if it's to show off to others or to not so much to integrate the teaching within themselves, so as to have some experience so that you are moved. Make some transformation within, and therefore it's very unfortunate if people having studied the classical texts only give lip service to it, just to have a silver tongue with regard to the teaching of the Buddha and not be practical. So since the conditions were all ripe, we could not do. Even in my own generation, when I was young, many of the cases, many of the things that happened, events that happened, in those days, when I look back in retrospect, I think, oh, we could have done such and such to avoid those things. But what to do? And then the 13th Dalai Lama also took initiative, made initiatives to make changes, such as building a stronger connection between the people in the central government and those in the Kham and Amdo regions, but it wasn't successful. So if we look, we go back in history, we actually have created these kind of conditions for our loss since Tibet became a fragmented state. But although politically we were fragmented, we lived in different regions without much contact, but all of us were held together by our the culture, Buddhist culture, the Kanjur and Tengur canonical texts have spread to the Himalayan regions of India as well as the Mongolia and the republics within the Federation of Russian Federation. So all Tibetans, wherever they live, are held together as one people by this teaching of the Buddha, that the culture. Although we, whether we understand what is meant by taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha or not, we have been people who take refuge in the three jewels. And so this is what has held us together, the teaching of the Buddha. So when I give public talk, whenever I give this public talk, so what I was going to say is, so even I have, since coming into exile until now, I've met so many different people from so many different backgrounds and many different religious traditions, as well as many different scholars and practitioners of Buddhism from different countries, different traditions, and have discussions with them and sharing with them. A lot of them I've done. And then I've met people business world, as well as science. And so from having met with all these different kinds of people, the conclusion that I draw is that I always say, the first thing we have to be aware of ourselves is the being human beings. So when I first came to exile, there were 6 billion human beings. But today it's 7 billion. And then at the end of this century, it is said that the population would be 10 billion, it is said. So there are 7 billion people today. So I am one of these 7 billion people, each of us, in fact, is an individual amongst these 7 billion. So each individual's happiness is very much linked to the 7 billion people on this earth. As earlier, there was a debate on equaling, exchanging self and others. When we say disregarding one's own happiness, abandoning one's own happiness, doesn't mean that the Bodhisattvas do not want their own happiness, because there is this aspiration for enlightenment. So sometimes in the West, people get this idea that, the Bodhisattva ideal is about forsaking one's own happiness completely and not thinking anything about oneself. But when we profess the Bodhisattva ideal, which is to say that we are going to help others, of course, we also should know how to go about with such a project. And without knowing the different means to do so yourself, how can you help others? It's similar to a teacher. Without knowing the subjects, the person cannot become a teacher to teach the students. Although the Bodhisattvas are dedicated more to serve other sentient beings, but they also realize that in order to be able to help others infinitely, effortlessly, they need also to become a fully enlightened being themselves, and therefore they seek enlightenment of omniscience, omniscient state of Buddhahood, in order to be able to help others. And therefore, within the cultivation of bodhicitta, we have this motivation to help others and also the intention to become a Buddha yourself. So both these aspirations actually qualify a bodhicitta. And therefore, a bodhisattva is someone who is an intelligent being who is thinking of helping others and not just always complaining or there is suffering everywhere. So they are courageous beings, intelligent beings, who make the pledge to help other sentient beings, all other sentient beings. So in reality, we all say that we all talk about all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness. May they be separate or free from suffering. So if that is the prayer that we make, then we should do something when we have the opportunity to serve others. For example, right now, we are living very comfortably. Of course, you may be those who are feeling hot. If we compare ourselves to some other states in India, this morning I heard in the news that 1,000 people have died in India in the hot climate regions. So because of this heat. So of course, some of these cases may be because of lack of, you know, and sanitation and so forth. But most of these people are very poor people who have nothing, nobody really to look for. And then when they become sick, they can't move, and then they die perhaps. And in Nepal, there are people, because of the earthquake, the recent earthquake, some people have lost everything, have nothing left. And then in America, in the California region, there is lots of flood. Is it flood? Drought? It's all the same flood. I don't know where. So it's natural disaster. With regard to natural disasters, there's nothing much we can do about them. But when it comes to the problems that are created by ourselves as human beings, like killing each other in Iraq, Nigeria, and Syria, and also in Burma recently, because of the immigrants from Burma, because of persecution by Buddhists, they escaped their country, and then there were people who take advantage of such immigrants and take them on their boats. And when in their voyage, the people are deprived of food. And so people have become really sick and reached the Thai border and Malaysia border, and they got these governments of these countries also are not actually taking care of these people. So if we actually put effort, take some responsibility, we can solve these problems. So these problems are man-made. And therefore, we have the responsibility as humans. And so, such poor people, the whole family, like, they could just cry. So what can we do for this? Of course, even if we cannot do something immediately, since these are created by humans, we could do something about it if we give thought to it by inculcating a warm-heartedness in ourselves. So you have seen Archbishop Desmond Tutu recently. Wasn't he quite jovial and funny? So we are very close friends. So in our discussion, recent discussion on joy, I said that I So he said that he will be going to, after that he will be going to his heaven, and you, he said that you are going to referring to me, you are going to some other heaven. And so in Canada or somewhere, at one meeting of Nobel laureates, he praised me a lot. And then right after that, and then after having praised me so much, in the end he said, unfortunately, such this great person, this very good person, is not a Christian. And so he's such a joker. I also said recently that you are really an altruistic person, very good person, but unfortunately you are not a Buddhist. And so at the end of our discussion, for this life to have a happy and peaceful life without any violence, it is the responsibility of each and every one of the 7 billion people. It's not just talking about the what they call happiness for the whole humanity, but when humanity is happy and peaceful, then you as an individual also benefit. If humanity as a whole remains unhappy, violent, without any peace, then you as an individual will suffer consequently. And therefore, for the whole humanity to live a happy, peaceful life, it's our responsibility of the human beings, the 7 billion human beings. But where we go next life, in the next life after our death, is an individual matter. So I said, so your own interest is included within this interest of the 7 billion people, and therefore we should feel responsibility. So to some journalists also, I said that when we think about my nation, like in Burma, for example, when people think only of my country, Burma, then forget about other countries and this more division. And then within amongst the religious followers also, we make this division, saying my religion, their religion, and then people engage in killing as well. This is very unfortunate. All religions talk and teach love and compassion, affection, but that very tool for cultivating love, compassion, is used to kill others, to divide others. It's like the medicine turned into a poison. It's not a natural disaster that is happening, but it is us as humans who are creating such problems. So we have to actually think about what I can do to solve the problems around the world. There are many people who are killing each other. We cannot just say, how pity. I really feel compassion towards others. We just can't say that alone. But since we all, as Buddhists, and called Tibetan Buddhists, we say, may all sentient beings have happiness. As Buddhists, we say, may all beings have happiness, and may all sentient beings be free from suffering by sitting on a cushion. Although we say this, we express this in our voice, but if we do nothing, then that's just a lip service. It's just an empty word. If you really don't feel some responsibility to do something, really, then you should not say, make these prayers. So, of course, we cannot do much about the beings in other galaxies, in the infinite other galaxies, but this world is something that we are linked to, that we have connection. So So there are lots of different sentient beings, such as insects and animals, other animals and so forth. And they are undergoing so much suffering as well, but there's not much we can do. We cannot talk to them. We cannot actually express through language. And we cannot talk to them. But as human beings, we have language to communicate. We have this intelligence. And so there's something that we can do about the problems and conflicts in the world today. If we actually look for the different, for some ways out of this. So the 7 billion people on this earth, I usually say that the happy humanity, I will, in my generation, in my life, I won't be able to see it. But you, the younger generation here, maybe at the towards the end of your life, you will be able to see such a peaceful, nonviolent world and happy world. So if that is possible, then we should, it's worth putting effort. If we cannot, if it's not achievable, then of course there's nothing we can do. But it's possible, and therefore the time has come for us to really reflect on this matter. And so, on the first level, we are human beings. Therefore, I say that we should have this sense of oneness of 7 billion humans. So I always mention this. So all of us have the potential for altruism and also to understand that everyone wants happiness, not suffering, and we have the right to achieve the goal. And so if we could inculcate the warm heart in ourselves, love and compassion in him beings, then we can actually solve the problem of killing each other as well. And on a secondary level, I am a Buddhist monk and a Buddhist practitioner. So as a Buddhist practitioner and a Buddhist monk, of course, the different religious traditions have different philosophical ideas and concepts which are necessary because of the mental dispositions of the different people, different followers. Even amongst the followers of the Buddha, there are those who are following the lesser vehicle and greater vehicle and so forth. And then there are the four different philosophical traditions or schools based on different mental capacities or intellectual capacities. So from this what we learn is that the religious traditions, although have different philosophical traditions, all have the message of love and compassion. And therefore, so it is the case with Christianity, Hinduism, Jainism, and Judaism, and so forth. And so, and therefore, all religious traditions should be respected. And then, with regard to the religious traditions, I say that there is a religious aspect, there is philosophical aspect, and then there is also a cultural aspect of each religion. So people's habits and customs come under this third category. So with regard to the religious side, religious aspect, so even the theistic religious followers talk about love, compassion, tolerance, and forgiveness, contentment. So all teach the same, have the same message. And then philosophically speaking, there is, as I said earlier, there are big differences. But they are necessary. As if we were to just follow one single philosophical idea, it's not possible to have one philosophical idea that fits all 7 billion. And historically speaking, we have these different philosophical ideas, philosophical theses, and this cannot be kind of wiped out. And then with regards to, so these philosophical different philosophies are needed. And then with regard to the third aspect, cultural aspect, all these religious traditions evolved during the last 2,000 to 3,000 years. In India, for example, the first religious tradition was Sankhism. And then in the Arabic region, Zoroastrianism, and so Christianity. And so in those days, when the religious, these religious traditions were forming, the regions were actually following feudal system. So a Buddha is somebody exceptional in the monastic discipline, the text on monastic discipline. He says that when it comes to making a decision about the community of monastery, it cannot be decided by a single individual monk, a bhikshu, but it has to be decided by a congregation of the community of monks, of 5 monks and so forth. So, for example, we are talking about the revival of called institution of the Gelongma, the Bhikshuni ordination in the Tibetan community. I also support that. So we talk about the 4 Sangha members, which are the 2 laypersons, male and female, practitioners with vows, and also the fully ordained monks and nuns, bhikshus and bhikshunis. And so since in Tibetan community we don't have a bhikshuni lineage, I also support or advocate to have the bhikshuni ordination. But this has to be decided by sanghas. So it seems in Buddhism we have the idea or the practice of democracy. But organized religions, for example, institutions of the Dalai Lamas. Since the second Dalai Lama, Gendun Gyatso's time, the Garden Potong institution started. And then we also were in a feudal social setup. And then within those who are the workers, the serfs were under different categories, like the servants were under some monasteries, some were under some private estates, some were under the government, and so forth. So around 2000, since about 2,600 years, there had been animal sacrifice at a great scale. And because of that, the farmers' income of economic situation also degenerated. And because of that, according to that kind of and within that kind of environment, the Jainism evolved, emphasizing vegetarianism and emphasizing non-violence, ahimsa. So when the Jain practitioners walk on to some place, they actually emphasize not harming even insects, even these small creatures that walk or that crawl on the earth, or on the ground. They take some kind of a broom and to sweep the land as they move. And also they cover their mouths to avoid killing animals. And so Jainism objected to the sacrifice of animals. And then with regards to Islam, in the Sharia law, there are punishments such as cutting one's hand, where if you steal, so around the time there were lots of criminals around the Arab region, and because of that, Muhammad actually to curb these criminals. In Quran, Muhammad laid down the Sharia law. So these are in accordance with the cultural habits or customs. So these cultural aspects may not be taken as religious or philosophical ideas and concepts, but just cultural aspect. And so the religious aspect, such as love, compassion, and so forth, do not need any change. Love and compassion will always be valued. When there comes a time when human beings are produced from machines, who would just as they were produced, they could just walk and need no breastfeeding and mother's love and care. So unless such a time comes for the next thousands, tens of thousands of years, the value of love and compassion will remain. And then with regard to philosophy, the theistic religions say there's creator God, of course, which is very beneficial to many people. The theistic religious followers say that we are all created by God, and so everything what happens to us is in the hands of the God. And what is that God? And they say the God is infinite love, and therefore it gives a sense of love. And therefore, since we are created by such an infinite love, God, we also have, they say, a spark of that love. Like we talk about the genes that come from the parents. And so in Tibetan, there's a saying, the son of or child or son of a good father. So as a good then we come, according to the theistic religions, we are created by such a loving God. Therefore, we could also call ourselves good children of the father. And so it helps to cultivate love and compassion towards others as well. And then those non-theistic religious traditions assert that things come through causes and conditions, as you have already debated earlier. When we talk about karma, action or karma, what we experience is because of our own karma and actions. So it falls on us what we experience. And if you kill somebody, what happens is you, because of that action, you go to prison, for example. And then if you help others, if you benefit others, then they also like you. And so if you do something good, the consequence is good for you. If you do something harmful to others, then the consequence is harm to yourself. And so this is what karma is about. And we see that there's no creator God as such up there who does everything. And therefore, this also is very powerful for us to lead our life. And so, as long as this value, we value the love and compassion, these philosophical differences also will remain. The different philosophical ideas also will remain. And then the cultural aspect has to always change. So the Dalai Lama institution of Garden Podang started around 4,000 years ago during the 5th Dalai Lama's time. So when we and Tibetans inside and outside unite and gather, and we cannot follow this Garden Podang system of governance, and therefore I left the political responsibility. I've devolved the political responsibility. So when people's education or knowledge increases, and we have the, of course, the right and the to govern our country democratically. And so in the past, we also have this idea of Mangur Gyalpo, which means a king. Of course, the person is called a king who was elected or by the people. And so all religious traditions have the same message of love and compassion, and then different philosophies are necessary for the different mental dispositions of people, and therefore there is every reason for us to respect other all religious traditions. It's not just a sweet talk. Do you also sometimes when you meet some old people, do you say that, oh, you look very fine and healthy? So there are in the West there are politicians who are old, quite aged, but they actually act as if they are still very young and healthy. And then some of them you cannot even ask their age. So if you're old, you're old. If you're about to die, you're about to die. Why? Why be so fussy? So just, there are people to whom, even though they are so old and frail and about to die, we still have to say, oh, you look very young, very healthy, and so forth. That's just flattery. We don't need to do that. So the religious ideas, these ideals are something, the religions are very helpful to people. So, for example, I am a Buddhist practitioner, but when we pray that may all sentient beings become Buddhas, we inadvertently may be saying that may all sentient beings become Buddhists, but that's not practical. We cannot make all human beings on earth Buddhist. So it's not practical in a way, although we pray for all sentient beings to become Buddha, and even the Buddha himself at that time was not able to convert every Indian to Buddhism. But masters like Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, and so forth have actually argued against non-Buddhist practitioners and scholars through, and called, they never forced them to become Buddhists without. So Christianity, the practitioners of Christianity have actually done the greatest service to humanity through education. So I always praise them for that. But while they actually give education to people, they also engage in missionary projects to convert people to Christianity. That's that aspect I criticize. Of course, if there is certain people where they go do not have any particular religion as such, then maybe it's okay to propagate their religion. But where in a land where there are other religious traditions, such as Jainism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so forth, then if these missionaries actually go there to convert people to their religion, then it's it causes conflict. So it's not good. So as a Buddhist practitioner, I always sincerely put effort in promoting religious harmony. So this is what I do as a Buddhist practitioner. So all of you are human beings. So you should also take the responsibility, determination to work for 7 billion people on this earth. So please think about this. So whether you can do something about all sentient beings or not, but to have this, the 7 billion people on this earth, for them to have peace, happiness, you should think about it. So you'll have friends and colleagues in school, peers, and as you grow up, graduate from the school and go into the wider world, you should be able to also tell others that we are all same human beings, 7 billion of us, and therefore you should also tell your friends that we should take the responsibilities, have this sense of responsibility for 7 billion people. If one could actually spread this message to 10 people, and then those 10 in turn could spread to 10 people each. I mean, from one, you have 10, it multiplies to 10, and then 100, 1,000, and 10,000, and so forth. So in this way, we can to make transformation within ourselves and to have a compassionate human beings. We cannot be brought from above, from the heavens, nor from the UN, nor from the governments of the nations, but it has to be brought about by people, individuals, families. And so to have a good family, happy family, each member of the family has responsibility. Do you all agree? The answer is yes. And most of us are Buddhists, so we should work for religious harmony, respect all religions, and also befriend people of other religions and learn from them as well. And then, on the third level, I am a Tibetan. So I have, as the Dalai Lama, I also have the responsibility for the Tibet. So of more than 90% of Tibetans trust me. So the political responsibility I have already left completely. But until my last day, what responsibility I actually carry with me for Tibet is the protection of Tibetan environment, ecology. It's not just for Tibet as such, but it's related to the Himalayan regions and then the different rivers from which have source in Tibet, which flow into mainland China, the Yangtze River in China, and also Burma and Thailand and so forth, Mekong River. In Tibet, the source is called Dichu. And then to the west, we have from the western Tibet, there is the Indus River, which flows into Pakistan as well, and also Ganga, so and Brahmaputra. And so so all these rivers that have source, their sources in Tibet, actually are benefits downstream, or maybe over a billion people. And so if we could actually protect these rivers, it's not only for Tibetans, but these other regions into which the rivers flow in Southeast Asia. So I met an Irish scholar, a geologist. Is it environmentalist? He showed me an article written by a Chinese environmentalist in which it said that the Tibetan plateau, this highland, the effect from the Tibetan plateau to the climate, global warming, is very strong. The link is very strong. And so the Tibetan plateau, so because it has effect on the world climate for global warming, which is almost equal to the effect from the north and south poles to the global warming. And therefore, this Chinese environmentalist called the Tibetan plateau the third pole. So this is a Chinese scholar. From his many years of research, he has concluded that. And therefore, to have, it's not only for Tibetans, to have the Tibetan environment ecology clean and protected. And therefore, this is one of my responsibility that I take until my last day. And then Tibetan culture and what kind of culture do we have? It's a culture of peace, non-violence. And these two, in turn, are rooted in compassion. So most of you are quite used to saying, oh, how pity, how sad. So when it comes, somebody is about to kill a bug, of course you say, don't kill it. Sometimes you become desperate and with mosquitoes. And then you say, I pray to my Lama and hit it. So this love is some kind of some sentiment that we are used to since childhood. Tibetan nomads, they wear called animal skin and also eat meat, and so their livelihood is actually dependent on animals, and so they do have to kill animals for their living. But when they kill animals, what they do is they would lit a bottle lamp, and all the family members say Om Mani Padme Hum mantra of Avalokiteshvara. So they kind of recognize, acknowledge that killing an animal is sin. But while they recognize, but they actually accept that, they still don't have any choice. So I know some Tibetan Muslims. So there was one man who is no more now. He said that he and Liu Xiao went to the same school. So I met him in Kashmir several times. And so in our discussion, he narrated his stories, past stories. And then he shared his experience as a Muslim. As Muslims, they have to visit Mecca once in a lifetime, at least. And so, when they on their pilgrimage to Mecca, they have to do sacrifice animals. So this Muslim told me that when he actually was doing this halal killing, he really felt sorry for that animal. So, of course, as a Muslim, he should have felt that it was fortunate for him to be able to engage in that act because it is a sacrifice or an offering to Allah. But he felt sorry, he said. So in Mecca, there is this, what is it, Kabbalah? Yeah. So which is considered very sacred by the Muslims. So he told me this that when the pigeons fly in that area, the pigeons never flew above the Kabbalah but around it. And so he said this is something very extraordinary. So although he was a Muslim, because he lived in a Tibetan community, he has this habit of saying how sorry when he sees something, sad happening. And so this culture of compassion is something that we must preserve. So I have another story to tell. In the past, when 1,000 Tibetans were accepted as immigrants as part of a humanitarian project from America and moved to America, one of them was actually a Tibetan government official in the past, and he got a job to clean vegetables in a university kitchen. And so when he was actually washing and cleaning the vegetables, he would check if there are any bugs on the leaves of the vegetables. And when he saw any bugs or any, he would pick that up and put in a container. And some of his colleagues, who were co-workers, had actually questioned what he was doing. Why? Why are you doing this? And then he kept on doing that. And then when he actually finished cleaning all the vegetables, and he took the container of bugs to a safe place and threw them. And he explained to the co-workers, the Americans, that this is our custom, our habit. Tibetans, as Buddhists, we don't kill sentient beings or bugs. And so he told these Americans that it's our custom, our habit, or to do this, to save animals. And so gradually his co-workers also picked up that habit from him. And so one Tibetan with that kind of, who values the non-violence, not harming any life, was able to impact others. So when I was going from one on a plane from Delhi to some other place in the east, and there was few Westerners on the plane, and we got down on the on in Bagdogra, and these Westerners came to me, and when we were resting, and then while we were conversing, when a fly came by, and then a lady just clapped, squished this bug, fly. And so I said, oh no. And so this lady said, from now on, I will not kill bugs. So this is our habit. We talk about non-violence or ahimsa. So this ahimsa is extended even to animals, insects and bugs. So we have actually been accustomed to this culture for over 1,000 years. So whether we believe or not, whether we are Buddhist or not, we have this habit, which is something which we can actually, which could be a contribution to the world at large. And so it is worth preserving. So and then with regard to the Buddhist tradition, the Nalanda Buddhist tradition that we have, it is only in the, it is only with us Tibetans today. Of course, I know many Chinese scholars and practitioners, and they also follow the Sanskrit tradition, which where we recite the Heart Sutra. And then Nalanda scholar, who was Dharmapala, was the teacher of the Xuanzang, who came to India. So we follow the Chinese Buddhists, and the Buddhist Tibetan Buddhists follow the same Nalanda tradition. So on the one hand, we are following the same Sanskrit Buddhist tradition, and secondly, the Nalanda Buddhist tradition. But with regards to the study of the texts on Buddhist logic and epistemology, there are not in the complete text are not in Chinese translation, but we also study these texts and use the logic and the deductive reasoning that are taught in this text for studying other subjects like Prajnaparamita studies and Madhyamaka studies. And then the Tibetan language, when it comes to explaining and debating on the logic and epistemology and Buddhist philosophy, and through debate, it is only in the Tibetan language. So there are people in the West even also taking some interest in using this, as I said earlier. So when it comes to using the reductio ad absurdum logic and also deductive reasoning, saying, supposing this subject. It is so-and-so because it is so-and-so. And this is only in Tibetan tradition. Since it may have started, this tradition of debate in Tibet may have started sometime around the time of Chabachuji Senge. And we have the seven treatises written by Dharmakirti and Dignaga's text on epistemology as well, and also later Chandrakshita's Tatup Samgraha in Tibetan. And so, we Tibetans study these texts year after year. So amongst all the Buddhist countries, the texts written by the 17 Nalanda masters and so forth are that are in one's own language, and also that are used to study Buddhism, where through in order to become a qualified scholar, geshe or some scholar, you have to spend 20, 30 years to study the classic texts. It is only in the Tibetan tradition alone. So this is also something which can be of great help and contribution to the rest of the world as well. Therefore, I see it very important to preserve these as well. As I said earlier, with regard to psychology, dealing with emotions and so forth, and also the Buddhist philosophy, although in the past we left it within the monastic religious kind of training curriculum, but I have since some years I have been talking about actually separating them from the religious aspect. And so we have brought out, there are some of the geshes here who have brought out the books on, they really worked hard, very dedicated. So the book on science that has already been compiled by these monks. Do the religious teachers of the schools use these books to teach the students? Do you study? So somebody said, an elderly woman said she is studying the text, but none from the young ones. This elderly lady has nothing else to do, perhaps. It's a joke, but I appreciate you. It's very good. Satya Pandita has said, with regard to knowledge, you should actually gain and try to gain it, even if you were to die the next day. So it's very important to study. So I always say that when it comes to the Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist, the psychology taught in Buddhism, these can be actually universal subjects which can be actually learned by anybody. And so, from the many years of meeting with different people and discussing with them and sharing with them, it became very clear to me that this tradition, the culture that we have kept intact for centuries, not just saying this is our culture, but actually integrating this culture within ourselves. So you have to pay attention to that. Whether you take interest in religion or not is up to you, but The study of philosophy and Buddhism is very helpful to actually help your intelligence grow. So last year, was it last year? January last year or the year before? In Daebung, Mind and Life. last year. So 2 years ago, we had this Mind and Life conference in Drepung, and Arthur, the president of the Mind and Life Institute, has said in the public, in front of everybody, that he was not a Buddhist, but the explanation of mind and the stream of the continuity of mind, he actually found confidence in it, and therefore he said he actually believes in rebirth, and therefore in the next life also he said he wished to be a close the friend of the Dalai Lama and work to carry on your vision for others, for the benefit of others. And so he was not a, he's not a religious person or Buddhist as such, but he's a scientist. So because he found reason to say that a mind or consciousness cannot come from something which is not mind, but only from consciousness as its stream in its continuity. And so because of these kind of explanation, he found confidence in this. Whereas the Chinese actually go against what is empirical even. And so they are biased. So if you are biased, you cannot know the truth. So you have to be unbiased, impartial, as it is said in the 400 verses of Caryadeva, that you have to be unbiased, impartial, and that you have to be intelligent, have to have intelligence and aspiration to practice. And therefore, you, the younger generation, through your study, and you have to preserve this culture, this rich, so that you can also pass this on to the next generation as well. And so, as a Tibetan, my responsibility is to protect Tibetan ecology, to its purity, and also the Himalayan region's ecology, and then to preserve this compassionate, non-violent culture, whether individuals are Buddhist or not, religious or not. But, and then, this truly a deep and profound and deep and vast culture of Buddhism that we have. So these are my responsibilities until the last day of my life. So I actually introduce it to others, clarify about them to others, and share it with others. So you have the responsibility now. In South India last year, there are over 10,000 monks and nuns who are actually engaged in studying Buddhist philosophy. And so I said amongst the gathering that I have reached a point like a setting sun, and therefore you have to take the responsibility, so that when I die, I could feel comfortable that we have so many people who would be carrying on with the preservation and promotion of our rich culture. Otherwise, I would be quite concerned. And therefore, you, the young students, also are the ones who are going to take that responsibility as well. And then there are many teachers from different places. Teachers are very important. Paramanavartika says, Dhammakitti says, that in order to help others, in order to serve others, you have to actually be knowledgeable about the means to help others. And therefore, gotten myself. I'm 80 years old, but I still consider myself as a student of the Nalanda masters, those great Nalanda masters. Although I don't have much time, of course I'm aged also, so I always read the texts written by them that are contained in the Tengyur collection. And so I really feel admiration for these great 17 Nalanda masters and so forth. And I have actually found faith in the teaching of the Buddha through reasoning. So, of course, there have been great Mahasiddhas, but the texts written by them are not covering the general structure of Buddhism as a whole, but they are contained in the writings of the 17 Nalanda masters. Therefore, their treatises can be considered as academic subjects, academic textbooks. But the Dohas written by the Mahasiddhas are different for practice. And so I consider myself a student of Nalanda masters, and so you teachers also must take serious interest in your teaching in your subject and try to learn them thoroughly yourself and then share it with your students. And so please work hard. So we have great responsibility with regard to the Buddhist tradition as a whole, and also with regard to the Tibetan matter. Even if when we go back to Tibet, so what I have said today, you keep them in your mind, and to study what I've been talking about, you need intelligence. And so the more your intelligence and your wisdom increases, you'll be able to do more for others. And therefore, wherever you go in the future, you should be able to become a representative, Tibetan representative in those areas. So otherwise, amongst other people like Westerners, you can't escape your being Tibetan, because you would be, prominent amongst them, a different face. And so when they ask you what Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism is about, what is the Dalai Lama says that it's following the Nalanda tradition, and then the philosophical view is interdependence, and the ethical conduct of the Buddhism is nonviolence. And so when you don't have answer to this, for example, you become a good friend of somebody, and then that friend says these things to you, and you are asked, what about Tibetan Buddhism? What is it? And so if you say, I don't know, the person might actually spit on you. So the Dalai Lama actually, set up separate schools for Tibetan children with the help of Nehru, Pandit Nehru, and then all these facilities were given to you. Is this what you are now? Would you say they have not been helpful to me? So you have to study, okay? So the teachers also should take responsibility. Where we have lacked before, we can do nothing. When we have made mistakes before, we can do nothing about it. We just can regret that. But we should learn a lesson from that. And where we are lacking, what are the loopholes, and so that we can actually, wherever we have actually caused degeneration, we should revive them. And what we already have, we should improve on them. And so, should not lose the opportunity, miss the opportunity to do this for the teachers and then administrators. Please do your best. So today we don't have time for question and answer. And so tomorrow I'll give a short introduction of Buddhism. And I'll do bodhicitta ceremony. And then the day after tomorrow we'll have initiation of Avalokiteshvara, the deity of compassion. So that's all for today.